All right, so we are back and ready to dive in.
Yeah.
To this fascinating world of religion in the American colonies.
This is a really dynamic period.
Yeah. And we've got a lot of material to work with here.
We do. A great lecture you sent over. And
yeah, so we're really going to try to pinpoint like those really crucial moments, you know, those turning points.
Right.
And how this all came together.
Those unexpected twists and turns.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like, what were those things that really kind of set the stage for the whole religious landscape?
Yeah. And I think focusing in on a few colonies in particular today will help us understand that.
Yeah. And I think one of the most interesting places to start, I think, is Rhode Island.
Definitely.
Because it consistently, like throughout this whole story, it keeps coming up as like this unique place.
Yeah, but place of real diversity.
Right. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, that early influence of Roger Williams that we talked about.
Yeah, we've touched on him in the lecture.
Right. And his kind of vision for a place where religious freedom was paramount.
Yeah, it seems that Rhode Island became like a magnet for those seeking religious freedom.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, one of the early significant groups to arrive were the Quakers.
The Quakers, right. Yeah.
And they found a real welcoming space there to establish their communities.
Yeah. And then you also have the Baptists entering into the picture.
Right.
And even in these early colonial days, the Baptists weren't like a single unified movement.
No, not at all.
Right. You know, we see the emergence of these groups like the English Welsh Baptists.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's this broader distinction that starts to emerge between the Calvinist Baptists who follow, you know, the teachings of John Calvin.
Right.
You know, think of him with his emphasis on God's sovereignty.
Uh-huh. And predestination.
And then you have the Arminian Baptist named after Jacob Arminius.
Right. So we've got Calvin on one side. We can almost picture it visually. Arminius on the other.
Right. And what's interesting about Arminius is that, you know, he was initially tasked with upholding Calvinist theology.
Oh, wow.
But then as he was, you know, studying and grappling with it,
he kind of went his own way.
Yeah. He started to develop these like differing views on some core principles.
Yeah.
And this is where this like key divergence appears, particularly around the idea of free will.
Right.
Arminius and his followers really believed that individuals had this genuine ability to choose whether or not to accept God's grace.
It's a huge difference.
That's a huge difference, right?
Because that goes right up against that Calvinistic predestination.
Exactly.
The idea that God has already chosen.
Who's going to be saved, who's not.
And you don't have a choice in the matter.
Right. And so this like theological difference about human agency.
Right.
It really led to this clear division within this early Baptist movement
yeah.
in Rhode Island.
So where do you think Roger Williams' sympathies lay in all of this?
Well, I mean, given his commitment to liberty.
Exactly. Liberty of conscience in all areas.
In every area of life, it seems like it would be a natural fit
right.
with the Arminian view.
Absolutely.
And Williams himself actually, you know, had a period as a Baptist.
Yeah, he did.
And was instrumental in founding one of the earliest Baptist churches in America.
Wow.
So that's a, you know, pretty significant contribution there.
Yeah. And it's almost like his belief in individual freedom and civic life just naturally flowed into
right.
the Arminian emphasis on freedom of the will when it comes to faith.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we've got this group, the Arminian Baptists, and then it gets even a little bit more complicated.
Okay.
Because they also became known as the Six Principal Baptists.
The Six Principal Baptists.
Okay. And they based their beliefs directly on Hebrews chapter 6, verses 1 and 2.
Okay. So very specific.
Yeah. And these six principles were repentance from dead works, faith toward God, the doctrine of baptisms,
okay.
laying on of hands, resurrection of the dead, and eternal judgment.
Wow. So these like specific verses really came to define a particular
theological identity.
Yeah. And eventually, like, led to the formation of a denomination.
Exactly. A whole denomination named after that.
Right.
Really highlights how these nuanced theological interpretations could shape early religious communities.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's fascinating. But despite all this early activity,
right,
the Baptist presence remained relatively small throughout much of the 17th century.
That's right. Their real growth and broader influence.
Didn't come until later.
Didn't really take hold until the 18th century.
Okay.
And that's when we start to see the establishment of some important institutions.
Okay.
Most notably, Brown University, founded in 1764.
Brown University, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
Because Brown wasn't initially in Providence, where we know it today.
That's right.
Right. It was actually in Warren, Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
And it was founded by Baptists.
With a purpose?
With a very specific purpose.
To educate?
To educate and train
Baptist preachers.
Baptist preachers, right?
And what's fascinating is that one of the motivations behind its founding was this concern
among Baptists.
Among Baptists. That congregations in Rhode Island were drifting towards more liberal interpretations.
Really?
And moving away from what they considered Orthodox Calvinist theology.
So it was like a...
back to basics.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we need to make sure that, you know...
we're staying true.
We're staying true to these core beliefs.
And who better to do that than...
than a universe...
an institution of higher learning.
And of course, now we have this, like, interesting twist where you have this institution...
right.
...that was founded to safeguard, you know, a particular theological perspective.
Right.
But it's evolved into this prominent Ivy League university known for its...
broad academic and intellectual landscape.
It's amazing how these things change over time.
It really is. Yeah. It really shows you how intentions can evolve over time.
Yeah.
So we've got Brown, and then the 18th century also saw the rise of the particular Baptists.
Particular Baptists.
Mm-hmm.
What makes them particular?
Well, their defining characteristic was a really strong reaffirmation of believers' baptism. So this means baptism administered to adults upon a profession of faith.
Okay, so like a conscious choice.
Exactly.
Right.
And they felt like this was crucial for Baptist identity.
Got it.
But they weren't the only ones.
Okay.
We also should note the establishment of the Seventh-day Baptists in 1666.
Seventh-day Baptists.
Mm-hmm. And they believed in observing the Sabbath from Friday evening through Saturday.
Interesting.
Yeah, reflecting their understanding of the biblical commandment to remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy.
I see.
And this is actually a significant precursor to the later emergence of the Seventh-day Adventist movement.
Oh, wow. So this idea had been around.
Had been around for a while.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So looking back at Rhode Island as a whole, its defining characteristic was undoubtedly its foundational commitment to complete religious freedom.
Yes, absolutely.
Which makes it a stark contrast to the intolerance seen in other New England colonies,
right,
particularly the treatment of Baptists and Quakers by the Puritans.
Yeah, it's a real standout in terms of, you know, this early experiment in religious liberty.
A real haven,
yeah,
if you will.
Absolutely.
So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the rest of New England.
Okay.
Where the picture initially is very different.
Okay.
Here we see Congregationalism really holding a dominant position.
Congregationalism.
Right. And this was the tradition that came out of that union of the Puritan and Pilgrim communities.
Right.
You can almost visualize those white steepled churches that dot the New England landscape.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of an iconic image.
Yeah.
And just as a quick aside, it's worth noting that later on, some of those congregational churches, they underwent some pretty significant theological shifts.
I did.
And evolved into Unitarian churches.
Right.
Which is a whole other story.
A whole other deep dive.
A whole other deep dive. But yeah, just to kind of plant that seed.
Yeah. But despite that initial dominance of Congregationalism, other groups did manage to establish themselves in New England.
They did eventually.
Yeah. Over time. Over time.
You see Quaker communities, Baptist churches, and even Anglican churches popping up.
Even in Boston?
Even in Boston.
Wow.
So it's a slow but steady diversification.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's move south now.
Okay.
To New York.
Yeah.
Which, as you mentioned, started as this Dutch trading colony of New Netherlands.
New Netherlands, exactly.
And so the religious character of New Netherlands was shaped by the settlers.
Who brought their faith with them.
Right.
Their Calvinist beliefs.
Yeah.
As expressed in the Dutch Reformed Church.
The Dutch Reformed Church. Interesting. And so the early years of the colony actually presented this logistical challenge.
A challenge.
Yeah, for the church.
Okay.
There was a shortage of ordained ministers.
You need somebody to lead these services.
Yeah, somebody to lead. Right. So for a while,
they had to rely on lay leaders.
On lay leaders. Wow. So these are just members of the community.
People who step up.
Yeah, stepping up.
To read sermons. Read sermons, conduct services.
And just offer general pastoral care.
Wow. So they were really doing it all.
They were, but of course they couldn't do everything.
Right.
Certain things you needed.
Needed an ordained minister.
An ordained minister, for right.
So it wasn't until January 24th, 1638.
Which is...
just yesterday as we're recording.
Wow, what a coincidence.
Yeah, marking that anniversary.
Crazy.
That their first ordained minister finally arrived.
A 10-week journey from Amsterdam.
10 weeks, wow.
Across the Atlantic.
That's a long time to be at sea.
It is.
So that was a huge step, you know, in establishing...
formal structure.
Formal structure and the leadership
right.
of the Dutch Reformed Church.
And then along comes Peter Stuyvesant.
Peter Stuyvesant?
Governor from 1647 to 1664.
Okay.
And he was a staunch...
staunch member.
...of the Dutch Reformed Church.
Okay.
And actively sought to establish it.
Official and privileged...
privileged church. And
this had real implications. Oh, yeah, because he restricted...
voting rights.
Voting rights and other privileges.
To members of the Dutch Reformed Church.
So it's like, if you're not part of this church...
you're a second-class citizen.
You're a second-class citizen, yeah.
And very similar to the Puritan leadership in New England,
mm-hmm.
Stuyvesant had a real aversion to dissenting religious groups.
And who would be the main target?
In this case, the Quakers.
The Quakers.
Yeah. They faced considerable persecution.
Wow.
Under his administration.
So not exactly a haven of religious freedom.
Not quite, but things changed.
Things changed.
In 1664, when the English took control of the colony.
And renamed it New York?
New York, that's right.
So.
With the English came greater religious tolerance.
Okay.
Influenced by evolving attitudes in England itself
mm-hmm.
and the experiences of other colonies.
Right. So this... takeover by the English.
Yeah, it really opened the door. Yes. A much wider spectrum of religious groups to settle in New York.
Okay, so who are we talking about?
Well, naturally, Anglicans were welcomed.
The Anglicans, right.
Since it was now an English colony.
Of course.
But the Quakers also found a more accepting atmosphere.
Okay.
And even a small number of Roman Catholics began to immigrate.
So New York was starting on its path.
To becoming a truly religiously diverse and tolerant colony.
Yeah, very different from where it started.
Right.
Okay, so now let's turn our attention to a very unique founding.
Yeah.
William Penn in Pennsylvania.
This one's really fascinating.
Yeah, a colony that was really built on the idea of religious freedom.
From the ground up.
From the ground up, yeah.
So William Penn himself.
Okay.
He lived from 1644 to 1718.
Okay.
Pretty compelling figure.
What's so compelling about him?
Well, he came from a prominent and wealthy British aristocratic background.
Okay, so we had it all.
Yeah, but then he undergoes this profound personal transformation when he converts to Quakerism in 1666.
Really? So he leaves behind this life of, you know, comfort
and privilege
to become a Quaker.
A Quaker. That's right. And what's really noteworthy is that Quakerism, with its emphasis on the inner light,
yeah.
this direct personal experience of God,
right.
really resonated with people across all social strata.
Oh, wow. So it wasn't just...
it wasn't just the poor and downtrodden.
Right.
It appealed to the elite and the working class alike.
Wow. So there was something really powerful about that message.
There was.
Yeah. Okay. So then what happens?
Well, in 1681, he receives a huge land grant from King Charles II.
Really?
Yeah. Essentially establishing the territory that would become Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania Penn's Woods.
That's right.
Right.
And then the following year, in 1682, he founds the city of Philadelphia.
The city of brotherly love.
The city of brotherly love, which really reflected those Quaker values of peace and community and tolerance.
Yeah, so it's like this whole colony is really being founded.
On these ideals.
On these very specific ideals.
Yeah, and his own experiences of persecution as a Quaker.
Right, because he had faced persecution.
Yeah, they really shaped his vision for Pennsylvania.
Okay.
He wanted to create a colony where religious toleration wasn't just permitted.
But actively embraced.
Actively embraced a true sanctuary
yeah.
for those fleeing religious conflict.
So this really attracted...
a wave of immigrants.
A wave of immigrants.
Yeah, seeking freedom of conscience.
Wow, so who are we talking about here?
Well, one of the most notable groups to arrive were German immigrants.
Right.
And they represented a variety of religious traditions.
So not just one specific...
no. Not at all. The largest group was the German Lutherans.
Okay.
And this marks the significant arrival of a distinct branch of the Reformation.
Separate from the Calvinists.
Separate from the Calvinist traditions that had largely characterized earlier settlements.
So we're getting even more diversity.
Yeah, even more branches of Protestantism coming into the picture.
Right.
And then we see other interesting German denominations like the Dunkers.
The Dunkers.
Yeah, who held a strong conviction in baptism by immersion. And the fact that there's a section of Philadelphia known as Germantown.
Germantown.
Right.
Yeah.
Really illustrates that significant German presence.
Yeah. And their lasting contribution.
To the colony's cultural and religious identity.
Absolutely. And so this environment of religious freedom in Pennsylvania also facilitated the establishment of other denominations.
Yes.
Right. So in 1707, we have the formation of the first Baptist Association in Philadelphia.
Right. And what's crucial to understand about Baptist churches is their fundamental belief in the autonomy of each local congregation.
Okay, so there's no, like, Pope or Bishop.
No centralized hierarchy governing individual Baptist churches.
This is the association.
It was a way for these independent congregations to come together.
Okay, for like support.
For mutual support fellowship.
Okay.
And to discuss common concerns.
Without losing their independence.
Without relinquishing their individual autonomy.
Right, so it's like a loose network.
A loose network coming together.
Okay.
And then similarly, in 1706, the first presbytery in America was established in Philadelphia.
The presbytery, now what is Presbyterianism?
Presbyterianism, it's also rooted in the Calvinist theological tradition.
Okay.
But they operate with a system of shared governance.
So they're a little different.
Yeah, where authority is distributed between local congregations and a broader association of lay elders and ordained pastors.
So they have a little bit more structure?
A bit more structure, yeah.
Okay.
So all of this flourishing of diverse religious groups led to Pennsylvania gaining a strong reputation by the early 18th century as a colony characterized by remarkable religious variety.
Like a true melting pot.
A true melting pot. You've got Lutherans, various Baptist groups with different theological nuances.
Okay.
Presbyterians, Anglicans, and of course, a significant Quaker population.
So it's a really diverse place.
It really was.
Okay, so let's move on to
Lord Baltimore.
Lord Baltimore.
And the founding of Maryland.
Maryland, okay.
So George Calvert, later known as Lord Baltimore, was initially an Anglican who later converted to Roman Catholicism.
Okay.
And in 1632, he secured a charter for the Maryland colony.
With the intention of?
Establishing a colony that would embrace religious toleration.
So a haven for Catholics?
Yeah, that was definitely part of the vision.
Okay.
So the first settlers arrive in 1634 after Lord Baltimore's passing.
Oh, okay.
Aboard a ship named after Queen Mary.
Interesting.
And while Maryland was intended as a haven for Catholics, who were welcomed, it's important to recognize that they didn't actually constitute the majority of the early settlers.
Really?
Yeah, the majority of those who arrived on those first ships
were actually Anglicans.
Were Anglicans, that's right.
Wow. So even though it was envisioned as this Catholic haven,
it wasn't exclusively Catholic.
Not at all.
No.
Okay.
And ultimately,
the Church of England?
The Church of England, or the Anglican Church. Oh, sorry. Became the established Church of Maryland.
Okay, by law.
By law, largely through the influence and efforts of Thomas Bray.
Thomas Bray. Now, who was he?
He served as the commissary.
The commissary?
Yeah, essentially the Bishop of London's representative and overseer for the Maryland colony.
So he was the
man
on the ground for the Anglican Church.
Exactly. And he played a really vital role in solidifying their presence.
Okay. And he was instrumental in establishing two important religious societies.
Two societies.
Okay. What were those?
The first was the Society for the Promotion of Christian Knowledge, or SPCK.
SPCK.
And they focused on building libraries.
Library.
And distributing religious literature in the colonies to promote Christian understanding.
Primarily from an Anglican perspective.
Primarily, yeah.
Okay, and the second?
The second was the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts.
Okay, SPG.
SPG. And they had a broader missionary focus.
Okay.
Including efforts to evangelize among Native American populations.
Oh, wow. So they were really trying to spread.
Spread the word.
The word.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have this situation in Maryland where the Anglican Church is established.
It is.
But it's still relatively open to other religious groups.
It is, yeah.
Okay.
However.
There's always a however.
Voting rights and the ability to hold public office were generally restricted to Anglicans.
Okay, so still some limitations.
Some limitations, yeah.
Yeah.
Finally, let's head to Virginia.
Virginia, okay.
And explore its early religious landscape.
Now, Jamestown, Virginia.
Yeah.
That was established way back in 1607.
One of the first.
One of the first permanent English settlements.
Right.
And by the 1620s and 1630s,
the population had become predominantly Anglican.
Predominantly Anglican. Okay.
But Virginia faced unique challenges.
Okay. What kind of challenges?
Well, due to its geography.
Okay.
You know, those dispersed settlement patterns.
Very different from New England.
Very different from the concentrated towns and villages of New England.
So this made it hard to establish
a strong centralized Anglican presence.
Right, because you don't have those central
those
hubs where everyone can easily
gather. Right. And there simply weren't enough priests to serve those scattered communities.
Oh, wow. So they had a priest shortage.
They did.
Okay, so how did they deal with that?
Well, local Anglican parishes increasingly came under the control of lay members.
Lay members. Oh.
Through bodies known as vestries.
Vestries.
Yeah, and these vestries, they essentially managed the affairs of the local church.
Because they were kind of like
Lay leadership.
Lay leadership, yeah, filling the void.
Filling the void, exactly.
Okay, and how did the church authorities feel about that?
Well, this rise of lay control became a real concern.
Because it deviated from the structure.
Because it deviated from that traditional hierarchical structure of the Anglican Church.
Where authority flows from the top down.
Exactly, from the bishops down to the ordained clergy.
Right.
So the Bishop of London,
yeah.
He ends up dispatching James Blair to Virginia in 1685.
Okay.
To address this issue.
Kind of rein things in.
Yeah, to restore order.
To the Anglican Church.
And bring in more ordained priests.
Okay.
So Blair really reasserted church authority.
Yeah.
And he was also instrumental in founding the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg in 1693.
William and Mary.
Yes.
Okay.
Primarily intended to educate Anglican clergy and lay leaders.
Okay, so another institution of higher learning.
Yeah, but what's interesting is that in its early years, the college was quite small.
Really?
Only around 20 students.
Wow, what a difference.
Yeah, compared to the large university it is today.
So as we think about, you know, this early period of colonial religious history,
yeah,
several key themes emerge.
They do.
You know, we see this significant and growing degree of religious diversity.
Absolutely.
Taking root across the colonies.
Yeah, you've got different denominations establishing themselves in different regions.
Right, and it's really clear that no single denomination
held absolute and unchallenged dominance across all of the colonies. I mean, yeah. You have some that are clearly predominant in certain areas.
Like the Congregationalists in Massachusetts.
Right, or the Anglicans in Virginia.
Right, but the overall picture is one of
increasing religious pluralism
and the development of distinct regional religious identities.
Exactly.
And it's important to remember that these early denominations were largely
transplants from Europe.
Transplants. They brought their established traditions, theological frameworks,
yeah,
organizational structures with them to the New World.
Right. And they laid the groundwork for later American-born religious movements.
Absolutely.
And denominations.
And while the colonies generally offered greater religious freedom than Europe at the time,
mm-hmm,
these transplanted churches also began to face new challenges.
Right, because they're in a new environment.
They're in a new environment.
Yeah.
And they had to adapt.
To this unique social and political landscape.
Absolutely. The very freedom they found here created both opportunities for growth.
And the potential for shifts in religious allegiance and practice.
Right.
It's a really fascinating dynamic.
It is.
So it leaves us with a question to ponder.
It does.
What do you think? What do you think these early patterns of religious diversity?
Yeah, the challenges faced by these transplanted denominations.
And these evolving relationships between church and society.
Suggest about the future of religious life in America.
Yeah, what happens when those European roots
take hold in new soil?
Free from the constraints of the old world.
Yeah. It's a lot to think about.
It is food for thought.
It really is.
Until next time.
Until next time.